Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the FitCast. This is episode number 228. I'm Kevin Larrabee and we got the whole cast here today. First up is Dr. Jonathan Fast, who travels all over the place, does so much stuff. His life is way better than yours. What's up, John?
Dick.
And then we also have the much more humble, prettier,
grounded,
that's more well-spoken, appreciative.
Oh, I don't think about that.
Kind, so gentle, loving. You know,
I might get lucky and not say a word wrong this week. Yes.
And that's Lee Peel of LeePeel.com.
I'm like out of practice. It's been a while since we've done this.
Yeah, no, we are. We're back in full effect.
She said.
We're like LFO. We're coming back. Okay.
Isn't one of those guys dead?
Yeah, one of them's dead, but you can replace him. All right. Anyways, we got a great show lined up for you this week. We're going to be talking about a bunch of stuff. We're going to have a nice roundtable on the FMS. We've been getting a lot of questions about that. So we're going to kind of lump it all into one discussion. And hopefully we will have time to get into the mailbag where we're going to be hitting on many more subjects. All the ladies that wrote in.
Yes.
So the first thing, I want to talk about any kind of Japan discussion. It's in the off topic, even like the fitness stuff in Japan. So people who ask about that, it's all at the end of the show. So you can stick around. There's about 20 minutes of that, give or take.
At least.
And John bitching about how he never gets to talk on... I'm not going to say my show, but a show that I started. And like I said, mailbag questions are huge. If you want to start sending in MP3 questions, I love the voicemails that we used to get, but no one's was sending them in anymore. But if you want to record like an MP3 on your computer and then email them to questions@thefitcast.com, we'll play it back and then we will give your question a little bit of priority when it comes to the show, because I think hearing from the mouth of the question asker themselves is much more interesting.
And we get lost. It's those mouths of the question askers.
Yeah,
that's what we really care about.
The listeners,
right?
The listeners. And,
that's an easier way of putting it, don't you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm, like I said, I'm really tired. I still haven't gotten a good night's
sleep.
No, you're
so jet lagged.
Okay, so the. And I want to quickly hit on the Adapure trainers, like the little Vibrams that Adidas has put out. And full disclosure, we get them for free at Boyle's. And Adidas is is the sponsor, or it's it's the sponsor of our gym. So the I will say that they are a nice step towards the Vibram setup, towards the finger shoes or the toe shoes. I mean, they will definitely admit the first version of the shoe that's out there needs a little bit of work. It's feels very squishy, and your feet sweat a lot in them. There's not a lot of ventilation. Excuse me. And what I will say is keep a lookout for the next revision that's coming in the spring. They are super dope, and they're going to beat Vibrams. I think because they actually look great. They look like shoes you would wear out in the public, and you won't look like a weirdo. Not saying that Vibrams look weird. I used to have pairs before my dog ate all my pairs, and they are
poor excuse.
I'm telling you, that friggin' dog ate all my shoes. But that's that. So good shoes. I might wait on them. Wait out like 3 months. And wait for the new ones to come out, and I think you'll love them because they look great, and they are the technology that you're gonna want if you want to get into the whole barefoot thing. But even I've noticed, like I've gone back to wearing shoes when I train for the most part, unless I'm deadlifting or squatting, just for the sake of convenience. But let's quickly ask Lee, what's up?
What's up with me? Not much. Same old as far as, work goes. Writing. Lots of writing. Lots of research. Lots of writing. Mm-hmm. So it's just head down time right now. I'm trying to get the book out by the first. Mm-hmm. So that's really, or of January. I'm trying to get it out for the new year. So that's really what I've been doing. Lots of head deep in research. And other than that, just running the challenge for the site. And things are kind of more busier on the members front than they are on the outside, I guess, world front for things. So members get a lot of modules and stuff like that. We talked about the last module, I believe, was about, or the next one coming up is about progression, kind of about progression mythology and what we think of progression and what actually is. Done some stuff on movement and mobility and assessments and stuff like that. So that'll be relevant to later conversation.
How timely.
Yes, very. So, that's kind of stuff that's been going on. So a lot of writing. That's basically it. Yeah, from a work area. On a personal level, I mean, I couldn't begin. I mean, I just don't talk about it because I don't want you and John to be jealous.
No, right. John's better than everyone, so don't worry about it.
So, but yeah, that's about it.
Cool.
John!
Yeah, what's up?
How have you been?
I'm all right.
Where are you right now? Are you traveling? Are you based right now?
I'm beautiful downtown Riyadh.
I would love to win a trip there when I go on The Price is Right.
You can take the
along with my new car.
The camper. Either a camper you can drive.
A new car.
Bring your jet skis to Saudi Arabia with you. Cuz there's so much water there.
Yeah, it's surrounded by, you know, a little thing called it's an Arabian Peninsula. Mm. It's kind of surrounded by water.
Mm. Lots of sand. All right. Stick around. We'll be right back. We're going to have a roundtable about the FMS, and then we're going to get into the mailbag where we might actually answer the question of if the NBA will be back for regular season. So stick around. All right, we're here for the roundtable discussion that we're going to have on the FMS. And I'm going to kind of start it off on where this stemmed from. It was actually a discussion that I was having with John a couple of weeks ago through Skype, just kind of off the show. But and I've talked to some other people about this, but I have like a real pet peeve when it comes to the FMS. And if people don't know what it is, it's functional movement screen. Greg Cook put it together, I think, with Brett Jones.
Lee Burton,
I'm sorry. What, about 10 years ago now?
Yeah. 10 years ago.
And
I think it was like 93 or something. It was their first FMS.
And a lot of people in the industry kind of use it as their gold standard when it comes to, you get a new client, take them through the functional movement screen to see what's going on. And the main issue that I've always had with it is I think a lot of people don't understand exactly what it is. And I don't know, where this stems from. But again, if you kind of break it down, and we're going to kind of go all over the place. John's going to definitely hit this on another aspect, and Lee as well. But it's called functional movement screen. It's a screen, not an assessment. And so many people who I talk to, and I'll say like, oh, what do you do like when you assess your clients? Like, oh, I'll take them through the FMS. That's not an assessment. It's a screen. And the difference there is a screen is going to be very general. It's going to be something, and maybe I should take a step back and kind of say what the FMS covers. It is a couple movements that you go through. You score it between a 0 and a 3. 0 being they can't even do it at all. One,
it's pain. Zero is pain.
Oh, 0 is pain. That's right. And there's also 1, which is, pretty bad, but they can do it. 2 is, they can just barely pass, and 3 is perfect. And there's stipulations for what is a 3, a 2, and a 1. And, for example, some of the movements are,
1, they can't complete it.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, it's actually important because
I didn't mean that in a bad way. Sorry.
One is that they can't complete it. 2 is that they can complete it with difficulty. And 3 is that they complete it without any observable asymmetrical movement.
Perfect. And do you want to just run down the movements? I don't know if you have those in front of you, but it's basically overhead squat.
Yeah, it's an overhead squat. Straight leg raise. Lunge. Yep, straight leg raise.
Inline lunge.
Overhead squat, inline lunge, straight leg raise. There's the step over. Mm-hmm. There's the anti-rotational ab thingamajammer.
Yep, which is same side elbow to same side knee.
Yep.
Like if you're doing a bird dog, it would be instead of the opposite arm to opposite leg, it would be same side.
There's an aptly scratch test, which they call a shoulder mobility.
Yep.
And then missing one, right?
Yes.
Is that six? And the push up. Yep.
And I'll kind of break it down. The two main things that I wanted to bring up, and then I'm going to hand it off to John, is that one, there's this whole topic on what that Gray said a long time ago. Don't build strength on dysfunction. So if you have someone that is dysfunctional, like if you find it a certain test, like say if they do an overhead squat and they get a one, or you do an inline lunge and they get a one, a lot of people took that what he said and basically said, thought, all right, so if my guy gets a one in the inline lunge, I can't do any kind of lower body exercise that is, near hip dominant until I clean up that pattern. Until I clean up that movement pattern and get him to a two, I can't build strength on dysfunction. Which, one, I'm pretty sure that's not what Gray meant. And two, if that is the case, a lot of the times you want to load some dysfunctions to give your body feedback to perform the exercise or that movement pattern correctly. And that's where R&T comes in a lot of the times is too. If you're obviously not loading it, and you're not building tons of strength, but you're giving your body some feedback to help you perform the exercise correctly, get proper glute activation. And the other main thing was that, it's kind of the end all be all in calling it an assessment, because, from my school, when I interned at Eric Cressy's, an assessment was very in-depth, and it was a lot of times sports-specific. Like for overhead athletes, you had to look at glenohumeral, internal, and external rotation, because that's a lot of times we see a huge deficit when it comes to overhead athletes from one side to the other. And that's something that needs to be looked at, needs to be noted, needs to be written down, and then it needs to be addressed several months later to see if you are making progress. I'll kind of hand it off to John here, but those are the two main things. And I think a lot of people are taking that functional movement screen and thinking that they can just use it as an assessment for any client. It's just giving you a very brief picture of what's going on there. And you do need to do further analysis to actually see what's going on. And that's where things like the Thomas test comes in, where hip internal external rotation comes in. Now, there's lots of other things that need to be looked at where the FMS isn't going to really give you all the answers that you're looking for.
Well, in defense of the screen, the idea of the screen is that that's the first step. And if there's something that's failed, then
I totally agree. I'm saying that the audience is not understanding what it is.
Right. Well, but the problem is, though, and here's one of the issues. I mean, I'm going to really break this down. I'm going to go through a lot of this research that's been done on the functional movement screen so far, but the idea of a screen, I mean, defining a screen, what a screen actually is, because that's kind of important. You need to understand, why they're calling it what they are. But a screen is something that you use in medical, in a medical field, typically. I mean, there are a lot of different screens. I shouldn't just say medical, but for this purpose, it's like a medical classification. And the idea of a screen is that you are testing a patient or a group that do not have signs and symptoms of any type of disease state or dysfunction or whatever you want to call it. So that's kind of like, taking your blood pressure. That's a good example of a screen, because you walk into the doctor's office and they'll just take your blood pressure. You may not have any signs and symptoms of any type of heart or cardiac condition, but they're going to do it anyway because it's a very simple, easily administered exam that if you're found to be above what they're looking for, they may go to further testing to then decide what's actually happening and why do you have this increased blood pressure. So that's what a screen is. It's designed to say, you look pretty good, but let's make sure that that's the case. So if that's the case, then the functional movement screen can absolutely be a part of that assessment process. But here's where it gets tricky, and this is where I think a lot of people and what you were referring to, where it gets messy. Where, you know, in order to diagnose something, you need an actual exam or test. But you also, there's a legal definition of that. And when the functional movement screen is advertised as being something that can identify movement dysfunction, movement dysfunction is a physical therapy term. It's a physical therapy diagnosis. I can write down in my evaluation that I have a, you know, movement dysfunction or dysfunction of the knee or something like that. So it starts to get a little bit messy. Now, a lot of people come out and kind of bash that a little bit. I'm not so sold that that's, you know, muddying lines, but I think it's relevant to say. But what's more important about that is if we're calling this a screen, then we have to understand how we evaluate screens. And screens have to do with specificity and sensitivity, and these are important concepts that we take from research, but it's also an important concept in any type of testing or screening that we do. What that means, specificity means that if you come up positive for your test, so you failed, in other words, you failed the functional movement screen. That means if you have a high specificity for the functional movement screen, everybody that fails is going to be injured down the road. So basically, if you're positive for the test, what the test is actually testing, you're going to be positive for. All right. So if that's wrong, if you're a false positive, that's called a type 1 error. So I might say all you guys failed, but some of you actually would not be injured. If we just let the time, you know, proceed, you actually wouldn't have been injured, so that's a false positive. You were told you were at risk for something, but it never actually happened. The opposite, sensitivity, is it's the opposite. It's where I rule you out, where you pass the test, and therefore you are not going to have this injury or disease or whatever. So if you score, usually it's a 14 to 16. Most of the times, most of the research, it's been a 14 is the cutoff point in the scoring. So that means that if you score above a 14, that means you're ruled out. You're not supposed to be injured according to the functional movement screen, and therefore you're good to go. You can start training. You can do whatever. A false negative there, a type 2 error, would mean that I ruled you out, but in fact, you did get injured anyway. So that's a false negative. In a screen, it's very important that we have high sensitivity. We'd ideally like both, right? You want to know that the people that pass the test won't be injured, and you want to know that the people that fail the test would be injured. But most of the time, you rarely find a test that has both high sensitivity and high specificity. That's just not very common. So when you talk about a screen, what's more important is that you want high sensitivity. Because if I rule you out, if I say you are not going to be injured, I want to know that you're not actually going to be injured. It's okay if I get a false positive. If I tell you that you're going to be injured and you're not, that's okay, because that's what the further testing does. If you fail the screen, you go for further testing. So that's maybe where I look for those, you know, specific asymmetries and range of motion or strength, or get more into the details. I run my special tests. I do whatever. The screen is just designed, if it works, to get everybody that might be injured into the classification and everybody that won't be injured out of it. And what we're going to find is if you look at the research by their own numbers, it's the exact opposite. The functional movement screen has, you know, moderate to some very good specificity depending on which study, and it has awful sensitivity, around 50%. And that's a huge problem with the functional movement screen as it stands right now. So what is happening is that people are being ruled out, they're scoring above a 14, and you've still got a 50-50 chance of being injured. That's not a great screen. So that's the first problem that I have with the FMS. Is it even screening anything at all? What's even worse in this sense is that, let's say you fail. So you fail the test, so it's a high specificity. So if you're a professional football player, there's been a study done. It was a 91 specificity. So that's a pretty decently high specificity. So 9 out of the 10 that failed actually would have been injured. So that's pretty good. But let's say that I now do the corrective training, the corrective strategies that come with the functional movement screen, and I get everyone above the 14. Half of those guys are still going to be injured because I can't tell you that scoring above a 14 is going to keep you from injury. So it actually can't prove that it will improve. It can't prove that it'll improve on lowering injury rates from that standpoint, because half the people, it's a flip of the coin. The people that pass, it's still a flip of the coin. So that's a problem. The second one is that the FMS, in a study that looked at women athletes, because it was a good study, they wanted to see what the scores were for females, because all the other studies have been done with males. They took a look at the quality, the worth of the FMS for females. Now the good thing is that they found that it was legit, and they could study women. They scored basically the same as men have. So all that stuff was good. But there's one really weird thing that came up. The study study this was actually. This was the I've got them all open here. My bad. Here we go. This was no, it wasn't this. I'm sorry. I have it up here. Hold on. Use of a functional movement screening tool to determine injury risk in female collegiate athletes. So what was weird about this study is the functional movement screen failed to identify athletes that had previous injury. Now that's got to raise a red flag, because previous injury is one of the key components to being able to predict future injury. It's everywhere in the research. It comes up constantly when they look at predictors. It's always, did this person have an injury beforehand, because they come up significant for future injury. They even point this out in the study, and what they said was these were ACL injuries. So these girls had ACL ruptures, and then they had surgery. And the fact is that not only could the FMS not identify them, but these women actually scored lower. They scored higher in the FMS, meaning that they were they may have passed the FMS versus failing, versus the girls that did not have the previous injury. And their explanation was, well, maybe they went through rehab, so maybe they were more mechanically sound. But the problem is that, I mean, that's possible, but that's not really what the research shows on athletes that injure their ACLs. In fact,
and
athletes
you're removing an important aspect of a screen.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a big problem. That's a huge problem. If I'm using a screen, an evaluative tool to predict injury, and this thing can't even find people that were injured previously, I have to question the quality of that screen, because it's basically something that we know predicts injury, and yet it's not predicting these individuals.
Well, for laymen following, if they're a little confused, a good maybe association would be, if you are getting a job that is involved in extreme high stress and you have a history of domestic violence, or if you had a history of like maybe an attempted suicide and a questionnaire or a psychological exam did not ask that question, that is missing a pretty big piece into a puzzle that would be important for that application. Something along those lines. So I'm just making a comparison in case people are following along, and why is that not such a big deal? That's a comparison right. That I think some people might understand on a closer level.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, if we have, you know, it's very difficult, and we're going to come back to this, the fact that it's very difficult to predict injury. I mean, that's what makes the FMS so appealing, is the idea that, ooh, maybe we can finally start to predict injuries at a more consistent rate, because we really can't yet. And yet one of the things that we do know predicts injury, the FMS isn't picking up. And in fact, it's not only is it not picking it up, but, you know, in turn, that means that the people that we know are predictive of injury are potentially passing this test with flying colors. So that just has to raise a red flag, and you have to look at that and go, what am I actually getting out of this? Because that should conform with quote unquote the gold standard. And I'm not going to say that previous injury is a gold standard predictor, but it's certainly of a high quality. It's a high level predictor. So that's a problem. Right now, as it stands, the FMS has not been studied on general populations. It's only been studied in athletic or active populations, which means that for all the personal trainers that are using the FMS right now, they have absolutely no information on it. You cannot draw any kind of generalizations. Even on the studies that have been done, there haven't been too many of them. So as of right now, if you really want to be assured that, you know, a study is legitimate, not only do you have to see that there was something good that came out of it, but that study has to be reproduced in different settings with similar populations in different areas, in different regions, maybe different ages. So you have to keep repeating these studies. Once you see consistent measures come up, then you can be more assured that a study is actually showing you what it's saying, that it's actually legit. But any one single study is more likely to be incorrect than it's likely to be correct because of errors that can happen in any given study. So although there have been a good amount of research attempted already, which is to their benefit and which is good for them, because honestly, like, half the stuff that you find in the industry has absolutely nothing behind it. There's no evidence on foam rollers, for God's sakes. But so far, that means that we can't really take generalizations. Maybe if I train professional football players, certainly if I train them in Indianapolis, because that's the team that the FMS was first done on, then maybe I can say, okay, here's a piece of literature and it's worth a try. But I can't then take my high school football team and say, oh, good, this has been made legitimate for football players, because you're training a very different population with very different field of play and activity levels and whatever. So I can't tell you that would work for a high school football team. So I can definitely can't say anything about the FMS for general population, where, you know, the strength, the activity level, the conditions, everything is different. There's nothing that I can say about that. And the problem is that people are saying it. They're telling people that are walking into their gym, they give them the FMS, they score 12 on it, and the trainer goes, you're going to be injured. And that's a lie. It's a lie.
Perfect point. Great point.
Yeah.
And I think could we say, and this isn't in any way to work for or against, because again, I don't have a lot of experience with this. I've only seen it used, oddly enough, I see it used a lot in chiropractic offices. And I see it used a lot in like PT places, more so that I don't really see it done much in gyms, but obviously the kind of gyms that are around here, there's not a lot of sports facility gyms. But regardless, could we say that more of the issue you're finding is the use of it outside of what they are claiming it to be? Or do you think that it's encouraged to be used in that format?
Do you think it should be used to sell programming to people, and that's
your issue with it?
I do believe that if you read the sales copy on it, and you I mean, look, everything that's packaged and sold. I mean, I'm ART certified. If you go to one of these courses, they're like, ART will cure your cancer. I mean, they think it'll cure everything, and that's obviously not true.
Can we pause for 1 second and just preface a lot of this? And I meant to preface this before we started, but mm-hmm. Again, if you're using the FMS right now, you know, keep in mind it's still something. It's better than doing nothing. And I still think that a lot of people out there, it is like, it's mm-hmm. like the intro to assessments. It is your, you know, your gateway to learning how to assess your potential clients and athletes. And I think it's good for that. I just don't like it being, again, I was talking with Lee and John, I just have problems putting my thoughts together tonight, but I just don't like how it is, you know, being put out there as like a, sales thing. And I will be honest, like when I worked at Boston Sports Club, when I did assessments, like I pointed stuff out and be like, oh yeah, no, dude, you know, we did overhead squats and you can clearly tell your ankles are immobile and your hips are incredibly tight. And, you know, that's one thing. But saying like your injury potential, I think that's dangerous territory.
And it is. That's the, and yet if we could prove that, then it would be fine to say. That's the difference. And I'm going to wrap this up because there are things that I like about it too. So I'm not going to just, you know, absolutely, this is really more of like a critique of literature, a critique of what we know and don't know. But there are things that I really like about it. And I'm going to bring that in because I mean, honestly, I have the utmost respect for Gray Cook and Lee Burton. I think that I love their minds. I love the way they look at things. And quite frankly, I probably look at things in a similar methodology. They're obviously way more experienced than I am, but I think that I probably look at things very in a similar methodology, but it's what we say about that makes a difference, you know, in my mind. So, but getting back and here's to answer your question, Lee, this is actually an example from when I was in a residency. And this will give you an idea of why this is important, why saying the specificity and the sensitivity and so what, and if we haven't proven it yet, so what. We ran a sports clinic, so a sports performance clinic. So every week, the student athletes that were in like the club sports, if they were injured, they would come in for an evaluation. It'd be like a quick, it was a screen. It was a quick, you know, 10, 15 minute screen looking at what was going on. And from there, we would recommend, hey, just ice it, you're fine. Or you need to come in and have this looked at as an official diagnosis, or you need to get to the surgeon right away because there's something really wrong here. So that was our screen. And one day I had a girl come in who was complaining of lateral thigh knee pain. And one of the tests that I did was the Nobles compression test. And that's a test to determine IT band syndrome. So the idea is that the IT band is causing friction against the side of the knee, side of the thigh there, and you basically squeeze the IT band and you have them range their motion, and if it increases their pain, then you figure, okay, well, I'm compressing this tissue, so this is what's happening. So I wrote down in my evaluation, you know, positive Noble compression test, the patient has, you know, IT band syndrome. And my director came up to me the next morning and said, hey, so I saw you wrote this. She goes, how do you know that they have this? And I said, well, they were, you know, positive for this test. And she goes, okay, what's the sensitivity and specificity of the Noble compression test? And I was like, whoa, I guess I don't know. Because this, you know, this is something you learn in school. It's something you read about. It's a standard test. But I realized that I didn't know. And when I looked it up, it turns out there's been no studies that validated the Noble compression test. And when I told her this, she goes, exactly. So how do you know you were doing anything? How do you know you weren't squeezing the side of her thigh and she had a bruise there? How do you know, anything at all from this test if you don't even know what you're testing or what the validation of that test is? And she said, so based on this test and this exam, would you hand the knife to the surgeon and say, cut here because I'm positive that this is what it is? And I said, no, of course not. She goes, right, so you can't use it. And I said, oh, that's a good point. That's the point of this. If you don't know that you're testing something truly, that you're ruling out people that won't have this, or that you're properly ruling in people that will, and the sensitivity and the specificity is so poor, or worse, that this hasn't even been tested on the population that you're using it on, what information are you getting out of it? But you have no idea.
That's kind of like an extreme to make an example, right? Obviously, but just to preface it for people.
But it's not an extreme because this is – you're telling someone you're going to be injured. That's extreme. Telling someone, because here's the difference too. Mm-hmm. I use part of my evaluations for personal training clients and even sometimes for physical therapy patients. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of similar stuff. And I just came up with that myself. It was never about functional movement screen, mm-hmm. but I was looking at like, okay, I know that eventually I want to squat this, you know, person. I want to lunge this person. I want this person to be able to do push-ups. So I would just have them – my evaluations are a two-day evaluation because I do a body weight and then I do a loaded evaluation too and then any test that I have to do in between that. But with that, I basically just gave them the exercises that I kind of wanted them to be able to do. And if they couldn't do it body weight, I might load to see if there's a change, or I might say, well, here, you know, I see scapular winging. I see – core, you know, abdominal core positioning, whatever. And this just tells me where I think they have weaknesses and things that I have to work on. But I'm not turning around and telling them, oh, yeah, you know, you couldn't do that push-up, you're going to be injured. And that, in a sense, I mean, the screen is more than just that.
Gray and Lee aren't saying to do that.
No, but no, Gray and Lee are saying that if you score less than a 14, you have an increased chance of being injured. That's what they're telling them. Mm-hmm. That's what they're telling
but
these people.
But is the wording, and can I ask, because I don't know, is the wording probable or is the word definite?
Actually, I can look it up here. Just keep talking. I can look it up real quick.
Yeah. Either way, honestly, at this point, with the
I was gonna say, if it's probable, is there justification for even saying probable? Do you get what I? That's where I was going from.
In my opinion, the answer is no. In my opinion, there's no justification to say that you will increase injury. There's the research they've done on the populations that they've looked at has shown an increased injury rate for people scoring under like a 14, or I think in the firefighters, or maybe it was the military one, it was a 16. But again, with such poor sensitivity, that also means that half the people that passed it get injured too. So what are you really telling anyone?
Yeah, I get you.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I could tell every single person that walks through my door, oh, you're going to get injured. And then if half of them do, oh, look, I was right. I mean, that's not really a great, you know, screen or a great exam. So I have to know that the people that I'm ruling in really would get injured. And I have to know the people that I'm ruling out really won't. And it doesn't meet those standards. And because there's no – now, like I said in the beginning, there's few tests will do that. But that's why we cluster. That's why we don't just do one exam, or if they're ruled in, we then further evaluate and then diagnose. But that's not really happening here because personal trainers and coaches don't have the ability to diagnose. Some of them will refer out. They'll send them to a physical therapist or an athletic trainer or something like that, and that is what you should do if you're practicing the FMS.
Yeah.
But what most trainers are not doing, and that's because they're being given, you know, part of the FMS is corrective exercise strategy in order to raise that score to a passing exam. So in a sense, they're offering treatment. And if you're offering treatment, is that still a screen?
Mm.
Or did you just suddenly diagnose
dysfunction? Did you use your screen to diagnose and then to perform
right, and then to treat? And then again, the problem with that is I don't have quality sensitivity to show that if I increase that score, I really will make a difference because the sensitivity is so low.
I just want to apologize. I don't have my Perform Better books with me. They're in storage. I forgot. But he has mentioned the wording quite a bit in his talks to Perform Better when he goes through the FMS type stuff.
I think if you look on their website, there's a lot of
stuff. Yeah, I'm poking around for it right
curious.
Now.
I was just curious. And I guess where the big question is to move this not just as a focus on functional movement strength, to move this into the area of just generalized assessment, is do you feel there is an alternative in place, or do you feel that this particular programming, FMS, or what it is that they're working on is beta? Do you think that it is – do you get what I'm saying? Do you think that it is moving in the right direction?
Assessment, you know?
Well, my answer is yes and no, because we do have certain things that we – and that brings up another good point. The FMS in a study took a look at its relationships between athletic activity, and it also looked at abdominal core strength. And no, those were two studies. I'm sorry. One looked at its correlation to athletic activity and a one rep max, and they found that there was no correlation between athleticism, so it was like a T test and a vertical jump and a couple things, and there was nothing. The functional movement screen had nothing to do with predictors of athletic performance. One rep max testing did. It had correlation to all of
obviously.
Them. Yeah. So right, but you could say obviously the functional
movement screen
did also.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
I caught myself on a second.
Now that may not be what the functional movement screen is testing. So we may be comparing apples to oranges. Yeah. But from a logical standpoint, you go, shouldn't that have something to do with athleticism? I mean, if mechanics are a cause of injury, then shouldn't the more sound mechanical people that are more athletic therefore score higher on the functional movement screen? And it didn't work out that way. That's not a damning. I wouldn't necessarily say that this is the most important finding, but I think that that's something that you look at and go, I wouldn't really expect that. You know what I mean? And that's one of those types of things. So there was no specific relationship to sprinting, jumping, or the performance, and had no significant relationship to sport-specific performance. And this was in golfers. That test was done in golfers. So maybe it has more to do with football players or soccer players or whatever, but at least in one examination, they didn't find anything. So that's, you know, maybe a little bit weird.
The other exam- also, well, go ahead. Please continue.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, couldn't there also be an argument, and this is just to hear you talk more. Couldn't there also be an argument to say as well that the compensations or any sort of issues that a screen may or may not find have absolutely nothing to do with the athletic performance in the first place?
It can, but if
this is what it is made for, because this is for athletes, this is not for the general population. This is, I mean, ultimately, what is this to do? This is to help performance and enhancement of athletes, correct? I mean, to prevent them from injury.
Well, technically, it's supposed to predict injury.
So that is its only goal. That is its only role to play is to predict injury in athletes.
Right, but, and here's where
it gets based upon compensations muddy. In the movement.
Right. This is where it gets muddy, and this is where you have to take the logical steps, so I don't claim that this is fact, but how is it doing that? It's doing that by evaluating movement.
And could that even be a bad thing in the first place?
And so if you're evaluating athleticism, which is movement, if we're assuming that through training we can improve athleticism, which we believe we can, and the one rep max, at least in that example, shows that, because the better the one rep max, the better the athleticism. So that's a way you train an athlete, is through a one rep max or squatting or whatever. Then they should you would think that there'd be something. You know, I mean, that's why they did the study, right? They wanted to see if there was any correlation, because you assume if you're training better athletes that are more, you know, injury proof.
Yes,
they're probably stronger, faster, because we know strength it decreases injury rate. We know that speed and reaction time decreases injury rates. We have ideas of all that stuff. And if the functional movement screen is supposed to be predicting injury, then you should be finding that the worse the athlete, the more likely they are to be injured. But that's not the case, because using mechanics to evaluate injury is really faulty. If that were if we were able to do that, we'd be doing it, because that's what everyone looks for. That's the goal of any coach. The idea is like, oh, I can fix up your form and I'm going to make you more injury resistant. And the problem is, research has not found that. It's found that in a few things. We have an idea that the spine works that way. If bad movement or lifting form can increase your injury rate. We have an idea of that in the knee, a lot of knee injuries, ACL, whatever, that there's a big component that's mechanical. But the problem is, injury is really complicated, and mechanics may at best just be a part of that. So now we're using a screen that is entirely evaluating, in a sense, mechanics, stability, and mobility.
Yes.
And if we're claiming the screen can flush out injury, and we're only looking at one aspect of that, then again, how good is that screen to actually doing any of this? Or do we need to fill the screen in with a lot of other things? And there's a study that kind of shows that in firefighters, where I was going to bring this also into anecdotal evidence, because if you listen to a lot of the coaches that use this stuff, they absolutely say, I've seen injury rates drop, and they may very well. But the thing is, they're not using the FMS in isolation, which is kind of what Kevin was saying. But when we're evaluating the effectiveness of the FMS, if we're not using it in isolation in the real world, then can we attribute any of this to the actual FMS? Maybe just the fact that they're implementing the FMS is making them look more closely at stuff that we do know that prevents injury. You know what I mean? So maybe it has nothing to do with the FMS, especially if the FMS is capturing a large majority of the people that you're evaluating, because it has such a high specificity. So it's gonna bring everybody into the pool of you might be injured. So if that happens, then everybody's going to be looked at as, oh, I really got to prevent your injury rates. And maybe that's what's happening. So maybe the functional movement screen doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the exercises chosen. It doesn't matter the scoring system used, because maybe it just means just the fact that you're assessing what you think is an injury prevention is enough to prevent the injury. You see? So it has nothing to do with actual FMS. That's possible, because we don't know yet. We don't know the answer to that. What I was going to say is the other study that looked at the FMS to core strength, and that was using McGill's evaluation, which has been evidenced to be predictive of back pain. You know, your ability to hold a plank and a side plank and, you know, looking at all directions of core strength. And there was no relationships found between core stability and the FMS. And that, again, that's a weird finding, because if we have certain things that we do know are helpful or predictive of injury, and the FMS doesn't relate to them, this is one of the standards of testing and evaluation. You have a gold standard, and then you evaluate the new test to the gold standard. How close does it get to that, to what the gold standard would tell you? And again, we don't really have a gold standard in this field yet, but for God's sakes, if we can't even get two evaluations to agree in a certain level, then what are we testing for?
John, if you're still not married in like 2 years, call me.
Mm. All right, cool. What was interesting though?
Seriously.
Thanks. What was interesting though about this study too is they took a look at performance evaluation too. So this was comparing the FMS with other performance predictors, as well as core strength. And what they found was that there's certain components of the FMS appear to correlate with certain variables of athleticism, but they were random. It was like increased performance to the right arm but not the left in the Apley scratch test. It was like random, so it almost you're almost throwing out those findings, so you're not really sure what you're actually looking at, because it doesn't make a lot of sense. They were saying that McGill's tests were developed to assess muscular endurance, and therefore in patients with low back pain, so therefore maybe it's not a great exam to predict athletic performance. But again, they're also not finding anything with the FMS. So it's and the findings of this study, this was in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research, this was a relationship between core stability, functional movement, and performance. Basically, their findings were the FMS is designed to identify potential injury in individuals, and it's ineffective in predicting performance. So we know we can't use the FMS based on two studies, which again, not great evidence, but nothing's come up yet. And if that's the case, then what does performance have to do with injury prevention? And what does injury prevention have to do with strength and power and speed? And what does the performance have to do with strength and power and speed? So we're finding things that we would think would probably associate, and they're not. So that's a little weird too. But again, not a damning of it, just a little weird. But finally, what I do like about the FMS, there's a high degree of inter-rater reliability, which means that if I test someone and you test someone and Kevin tests someone, we're all probably going to agree with our scores within reason. That doesn't affect the test. That is very good, because that you must have. If we couldn't agree, then the test is completely worthless. It's also very easy to administer. The test is quick and easy to do. And it's probably, I mean, to the tester, it's probably costly if you're going to go through the study courses and things like that. But in general, it's a quick and easy screen. Those are good things, and those are very important when we talk about screens. You don't want a screen that's going to be crazy to implement, because then it loses the effectiveness. You're not going to do it, and it takes too long to find information about people that have no signs and symptoms anyway. So those are good things. Overall, I think I believe in the idea. I believe in the concept. We just don't have enough information yet. And from my point of view, because this is really close to this medical kind of area of injury or not injury and prevention, we really need better evidence than this. So if I was a professional football coach, I might look at the evidence and say, you know what, screw this. If this saves one of my guys, I think it's worth it. And I think that's fine. You know what I mean? You're talking about guys that are paid millions of dollars. That could be the difference between winning and losing a game. You know what I mean? So that might be legit to you because you don't care if you get a bunch of guys in the weight room on a false positive, because if you can capture some of the guys that might have been injured and maybe you can make a difference in half of them, that's probably worth it to you. But if I'm, you know, again, Joe Trainer dealing with general populations, and what am I really getting out of it? Because the fact of the matter is I don't know how much this is going to make a difference because I've never seen any research on it. And I don't know if any of my my ability to increase their score has any ability on decreasing their likelihood of injury. And those are big problems. So I hope that these things will be sorted out. I know that they'll continue doing research on it. I love the idea. I love the concept. Just not ready to take it at its word yet.
Wow.
John, if just to kind of bring things a little full circle, what would you recommend? Because we do have a lot of trainers and, you know, coaches out there that listen to this. You know, what should they be doing to assess clients and, you know, athletes? Because they're not all going to be, you know, physical therapists. They're just going
right.
to take a general look and just make sure that they're covering their bases before they start doing anything with their clients.
The reason why, in my opinion, this is so appealing is because as a trainer or a therapist or coach, the only thing that we have the ability to do is change the way that a person moves. You know, I mean, we have the ability to increase strength and increase flexibility, of course, but the ultimate goal is probably to change the way they move, certainly if it's an athlete, but even if it's not. You know, we all play that game of, you know, let me get you, you know, your knees fold in and things like that, collapse and whatever. But even saying that your knees collapse in, that's a predictor of an ACL injury because that's the classical position of an ACL injury. So there are things that we know about in terms of injury prevention. There are aspects of that that we can affect. So my opinion is you evaluate the client or the athlete based on their needs. That's the way that it's always done. Specificity. If I'm working with a sprinter versus a wide receiver, those are, even though they both run, those are two very different running tasks. So for the sprinter, I may be more, you know, focused on their inline straight running. With the wide receiver, I'm very concerned about their agility and whatever. I need to evaluate the individual in their field of play. And if this is a general client for like a general fitness client, then I need to evaluate, are they sitting all day? What's tight? What's not? What's weak? What's strong? You know, things like this, just the basics and getting them to be more symmetrical in their movement, in their strength, and in their mobility. That's the only thing that we've ever done. The functional movement screen has the capability of doing that. That has been evaluated and shown to be, at least in one study, that they can affect the score. And if the concept of the functional movement screen is to improve your stability and mobility, at least in those seven exams. And again, the other question that I didn't even bring up is, are you training for the test or are you training for activity? You know, if I'm training to score higher on a test, then the argument
completely different than what's functional in the world. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Am I even doing anything to affect their overall? But having said that, I don't think it's a problem to say, you know what, I'm going to use the FMS. Just like you said, Kevin, use the FMS as part of my evaluation, as part of a tool. But I can't tell you that it means anything.
Well, I think
that's the issue.
Well,
I can't tell you that doing this will affect your injury rates in any way. If you happen to be working with one of the populations that have been studied, Army cadets, firefighters, professional football players, D2 random athletes and things like that, then maybe you can say, look, there's been very limited research that shows that this might affect you. And that's academically honest. You know, that's something that you can say, look, there's been one study. I'm not going to promise you that this is going to happen, but I think it's worth looking at. You can be honest with someone like that, but you can't tell them that you know, because you don't know. You just don't know the answer yet. That's what that little end line at the end of every research paper that you've ever read points to. More research is needed in order to whatever, because they know that their study doesn't prove a damn thing. But if you have 10 studies like that, then that certainly lends credibility to a body of research. And then you can start to become a little bit more confident in those findings. But that's the same reason why, and people have actually called me out on this too. I very rarely say we know this or we know that. When we answer questions on the FitCast, I always say, well, we think this because we don't have a fact. Yeah. And I would be lying to the audience if I said, oh, well, we know that this will happen.
You know? And I get called on that a lot too. And I'm like, currently, this is what it suggests, but that's not.
Right.
You know? And people are like, thanks for the depends answer. But that's generally what it is. It's the depends answer. It really is. We don't know yet. Well, we just don't know.
Wrapping up kind of my thoughts on it. I think John made a great point when it, you know, what I was mentioning before is you have to put some specificity into your, you know, the population that you're looking at. And for people that are, you know, just getting into the industry and they want to start, you know, understanding, you know, how to use assessments to take a look at their clients, to assess their clients, I think the FMS is a good place to start. I don't mean to, you know, make it sound bad, but, you know, it's like putting training wheels on the bike, and you learn, you know, what to look for, and you, as you see more athletes and more clients, you will become more familiar with what you're going to see in those populations, and you're going to know what to test for.
I mean, and
you could
not
just
to cut
get
you
the
off,
Bill
you would...
Hartman like visual assessment test.
Yeah,
right. Yeah,
well, I do that too. I look. Yeah,
man, Bill's the best.
No, you know, it's like just you know, get Bill Hartman's brain and like implant it into your head, and then there you go.
Well, there's no question. I definitely, a lot of that, my approach to assessment was absolutely influenced by Bill when I worked with him. And a lot of these things were his points too. I mean, I don't want to speak for Bill, but, you know, we discussed the FMS back then too. And it was a lot of the same things saying, are we training for the test or are we training for sport? And, you know, part of my evaluation, that first day evaluation, the second day, I can't tell you because it leads from the first. And the second day is partly training too. I mean, I'm just evaluating now what the exercises that I gave them, what are they actually doing? You evaluate every time they step into the room. So, you know, to say I do a 2-day test, I do a 2000 day test. I mean, whatever. But the first day is, I know I'm going to have them do a push up. I know I'm going to have them do an overhead squat. I know I'm going to have them do a forward lunge. I'm going to have them do a single leg balance test. I'm going to have them do a plank and a side plank. And I'll probably have, it's possible I'll have them do an athlete scratch, but a lot of times I get the information from the overhead squat, but, and then I may go further from there and then start looking at mobility and hip assessment and things like this and looking for symmetry and asymmetry. But the reason why I include a lot of those, the tests that I do is because, again, McGill showed us the importance of plank and side plank in order to, you know, evaluate back health. So I want to see that. I want to see where they're at. That second day, I'll probably have them go through, if I have time on the first day, I'll have them go through a deadlift pattern or an RDL or something, because that'll give me information on their spine strength as well. But I can usually get it from the overhead squat also. But I also look at the squat and the lunge and even the single leg balance, because I want to see what their knees do and I want to see what their feet do. You get a lot of information from that. And again, ACL injury risk, at least in athletic populations, but non-contact injury in general, also has that predictive position as part of the reason. But also, like what we were talking about with the FMS, that's not the only cause of ACL injury. And there have been all kinds of theories that have a lot of validation behind them as well. Things about hormonal cycles. We know that women get ACL injury at greater rates than men. So hormonal cycles have been insinuated, of course, strength and certain muscles, quadriceps strength, things like this. The nutrition is a factor, all kinds of things.
Ankle stability, so many things come into play when it comes to just one area. Absolutely.
Right. So to say that I'm going to cure you, I'm going to make sure that you never get an ACL injury because I'm going to teach you how to land and how to increase your strength, that's not true. I can't say that. But I can say that I'm helping it along. I'm helping you to be more injury-proof, but I can never tell you that you won't be injured. It's a lie. Don't have that predictive power. So that to me is like, I mean, that's where I come across with my assessment. And if you look at the stuff that I do, there are a lot of similarities to what the FMS does, but I'm just not claiming that I know that I'm preventing injury, but I am using some of the information that I know is available that does have some validation to it. And that's kind of the point. If there's something in the research that says you should do this or you should evaluate this, then you should do that. And if I'm using the FMS and it doesn't correspond to that stuff, like, you know, has been shown, that's a problem. We have to figure out why that's happening. And if the FMS isn't powerful enough to predict the mechanical causes of the possible mechanical causes of injury, then again, it's incomplete and we can't use it as it is right now for that purpose.
And just the second point I was going to make before you kind of added on top of that was, you know, the last thing I ever want to see when I, you know, talk to someone in the industry is, you know, having someone making the FMS the end all be all of what they do. And you, and unfortunately, you see it a lot in the strength and conditioning field. Like you see it a lot with the audiences that come to the Perform Better seminars where, you know, they'll say like, you know, I FMS someone and then I took them through, you know, the all the corrective exercises that came along with that assessment. And again, you can't get stuck in just using the FMS to cure everything and to observe everything. And I don't think Gray and
no,
Lee
and
put
in
it
defense
out that
of,
way.
No. Yeah, in defense of Gray, I've specifically, I have, now I don't know about Lee Burton, but I have specifically seen Gray say,
no, he's talked about
this
it on
is
the Strength
merely
Coach
a
podcast.
Small part
yeah,
of a big overall
yeah. no,
picture
totally has,
of assessments.
But
and like, I think it's cocky, not even in a mean way, but you learn things, you get cocky.
And you think you know
you,
the answers.
You think you know it all.
Yeah.
And I think, I know I've been guilty of it. And when you're care and you're passionate about mm-hmm. things, it certainly happens. But I think, and something that John brings up very, maybe perhaps subtly to some, but at the end of the day, words mean something. Mm. And you really are making some very large statements and indications about what it is that you're doing by simply saying, yeah, you know, I used this FMS screen. They had this dysfunctional postural pattern and movement assessment. And I went right in there and I fixed it with these exercise
exactly.
programs. And now they're not going to have any injuries whatsoever and going to be the most optimal athlete that you've ever seen.
That's exactly what I'm saying, yeah.
And that's not only not the case in what it was written for by the actual authors themselves, but it's just not the case at all.
People misinterpreting what they're trying to say. And, you know, I try to preface this before, but I'm not saying this is – you know, this is not a, you know, an issue that Gray and Lee created. It's an issue from what the people have grabbed the information and kind of ran away with it. And, you know, again, just remember there are, you know, it's like there's things outside your backyard. Like if you leave outside your backyard, there's a lot of other great stuff to look at and that you need to consider. It's the same stuff when it comes to assessing your clients, is you can't just use one tool. And like, you know, Leah said, Gray and Lee have not used, have not said this is the end all be all. It is a tool in your toolbox to use when it comes to working with athletes and clients. It's not the end all be all. So don't make it that.
Yes. And they have said that, but I will say this. If you look at some of the wording on the website,
I know.
It's a website designed
they're selling
to
a
sell.
Product.
And, but that again,
I'm
you
not
going
to say I like it. I mean,
right.
It's
no,
sales
but
in
again,
industry,
if they're leading, you know, if leading the consumer, the person that will buy this product down a certain road and like, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
No, I know.
That's
I know.
A problem too. But the thing is, again, we're holding this to a higher standard because it's claiming to be a screen.
It's borderline medical.
Okay,
it's borderline
right.
medical. And I think that's where it can kind of come in under more scrutiny. But you, I mean, and these things come in more scrutiny in other fields that are kind of borderline medical. And there's a lot of things about this that kind of approach upon this in the fitness industry. In fact, we all kind of live on this borderline of, wait, are we crossing the line? Are we not crossing the line? And I think that that's probably where the more waxing philosophical about this kind of comes from. I mean, wouldn't you agree that because that's where the borderline falls? It's screening, testing, diagnosis, treatment, and that's right. where it's kind of like. Yeah,
I mean, ultimately, again, it's the kind of thing where this is an evaluation, well, a screening tool based mm-hmm. on mechanics, where mechanics has never been really found to be consistently predictive. So you're what are we basing it on? We're basing it on something we don't have evidence for, you know. So.
Maybe
really
what we could do to give a little takeaway for the trainers okay. is maybe go through a fitness assessment overall. What kind of What do you, yeah, I mean, John, you talked about in your fitness assessment, can you list maybe quickly what maybe top couple exercises you choose? You said the plank, you said overhead squat. If you could just throw it out, maybe someone writing it down could actually know.
Yeah, I mean,
that. Yeah. And then go from there.
Right. And this is just, again, based on my experience, but I do an overhead squat. I'm looking for thoracic mobility there. I'm looking for shoulder mobility. I'm looking for hip mobility. I mean, I'm basically looking for what the FMS looks at. Honestly, that's how I would relatively score it. I do a forward lunge, both legs side to side. I do, and again, I don't have a specific number. I have them do, you know, like 5 or 10 of them, because I also want to see what happens when they get fatigued, which is not something that really the FMS looks at. But I have them do it, you know, repeatedly. I have them do a standing balance, so one leg is raised 90 degrees, one hip is flexed 90 degrees, and you're standing on the opposite leg. And I will typically do that with eyes open and eyes closed. I get a lot of proprioceptive information, and I look at compensational strategies on single leg balance there. So I'll take a look at, you know, information there. I have them do push-ups, and I don't really care how many they do per se. I'm more interested in scapular stability in that. I'm looking at core stability and general core stability and overall
forms,
movement.
Everything, yeah, yes, yeah,
like that. I have them do a plank. I have them do a side plank. And sometimes I might do like an Apley scratch test, but it just depends. Then I start getting a little bit more technical, and I might look at hip mobility and shoulder mobility and things like that, and I try to tease out any information that I may not have gotten. Otherwise, I'll probably get my hands on them and look at scapular motion and evaluate the hip integrity and stuff like that. But
we should preface about the you touching clients.
Yeah, I'm a physical therapist.
Yeah. He's a physical therapist. We're not. Yeah.
So don't. It's like legally, it's gray territory, but you shouldn't really put your hands on your clients and do any kind of manual stuff.
Well, and technically, and I'll just say this, and maybe it's a little easier because I'm a female, so I'm sure the guys have a lot harder time dealing with this. I ask my clients, and I simply say, you know, is it okay if I move this or help you do that or whatever, just to see what your positioning is. I mean, granted, it doesn't happen a lot. Usually I'm helping in the aid of stability if I'm afraid that they look like they're going to fall or something like that. But you know, I think if you ask, and obviously we're not going to be doing the kind of assessments that John does because he's a PT, but these things that John you're talking about in general, any PT could do, correct? They could watch a client do a plank, and they could see what their compensations are, what they're using in strength, and if their butt raises or lowers, or if they all these kind of things that come into play.
I don't really think that there's much here that a general personal trainer couldn't do. I don't think. I mean, you can check range of motion. I'm not breaking out a goniometer. I'm just looking at side to side asymmetry. You know, I'm just taking a look at that. I mean, now if there's an issue of reduced range of motion, it's always possible that I might want to measure that. But it's not typical, because if it's a personal training client, again, they're not injured. They're not coming to me injured. So that evaluation stuff is less important to me, because I don't know what this means if you're not injured. You know, I want to know your standard ranges of motion, but I don't know that I'm necessarily measuring that. I'm probably eyeballing it, you know.
Yeah.
And then the second day, whatever I decide that they need, I'm gonna probably get a lot of my corrective strategies from that session. I'm gonna probably get a lot of my program design from that session. What I want to initially start them with, where do I start them on the deadlift? Do I start them off blocks from the floor, from a hang? You know, what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
Ideas like that. And then the next day, I'm gonna evaluate with a little bit of weight in their hands and see what the strategy is, because we also know that weighted force changes everything in the mechanics. So if I expect them to be moving weight other than their body weight, then I need to evaluate that, you know, separately as well. So they're going to get into the exercise routine at that point, but it's still going to be an evaluation process, because I very much can easily change around anything if I see something that I don't like. So I think of it as day two of the evaluation. And so it's whatever I decided to give them at that time. I mean, if someone bangs out an amazing evaluation for me, then I'm going to go right into some, you know, a little bit more interesting stuff, or you know, pulling from the floor and, you know, looking at maybe I might even throw some bench press stuff in there. But if they've got poor scapular stability, they're not getting a bench, you know. So it's stuff like that that you're thinking about and evaluating. But it again, that's only because these are the things that I will typically do with my clients. I'll typically want them to do some type of, you know, squat or lunge pattern. I'll typically want them to do some kind of deadlifting pattern. I'll want them to do some type of push-up-y press pattern and some kind of pulling pattern, and then looking at their core stability. So if these are the things I want to do, I should evaluate these things.
And the reason I ask you to go through it is because I've taken four different certifications. Now I just hold one, mainly just because I like the NASM. I like the way that they do it the most. But I will say, some might be listening and be like, well, shouldn't all personal trainers know how to do this? It's just a generalized session. But most certifications that I look at, mostly they cover strength-specific tests, benchings or squats, cardio-specific tests. They don't usually go into any sort of range of motion or mobility tests or any sort of assessments about postural alignment or anything that goes into that. I know that the NASM does, and they utilize more postural pattern distortions and finding things like that. Yeah. So I think no matter where your certification comes from, if you're listening to this, you know, that's a very good way that you could kind of go to start generally kind of looking at your client and thinking, oh, well, these kind of compensations, these things happen. Maybe I can change up the training and I can use this exercise instead of that exercise because I have a problem with this, so on and so forth. So anyway, that's why I wanted you to go into such detail, because I do think that it is neglected with a lot of major organizations that do certifications. Yeah,
absolutely. ACSM, you do like blood pressure and VO2 max and crap like that. So we can tell you that, but there's nothing having to do with movement, and the NSAA does nothing. It talks about one rep max testing.
Sit and reach test. Come on, man.
Yeah, right. and but then the other side of it too is, like, if I'm working with an athlete, then I want to see what they need to do, and I'll evaluate a game. I'll evaluate, you know, drills, and you get into agility, vertical, you know, jumps and things like that. So again, it's just about what is this person coming to you, and what are their performance goals. And if they have no performance goals, if they just want to lose weight or whatever, which a majority of your clients will, and even athletes too, then you'll have your goals and they'll have theirs, and you have to make sure that they correspond and mesh. So I think in the bare minimum, you should expect that they will, you know, feel better, look better, be stronger, and hopefully they'll be less likely to be injured. But, you know, the whole idea of, like, improving their mechanics and their form, I don't know if any of that means anything, but I do know, at least anecdotally, people just feel better. They feel better when they're standing up taller, when, you know, they're not out of line. I mean, the whole idea of mechanics comes from a lot of what we do as physical therapists. If someone comes with a musculoskeletal injury, most of the time you're going to spend at least a portion of that trying to fix mechanics, strength and balance, asymmetry. And because that fixes injury, we kind of hope, well, maybe if we do this before they get hurt, it'll prevent it. Sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't, but it's the best idea we've got, but it really hasn't panned out too well. So it's a tough call. And that's where some of these problems with the FMS, in my opinion, are coming into play. It's based on an assumption that just hasn't been shown to be true in most scenarios.
You think that's a good place to wrap it up?
I think we should call it John Fast, Amazingly Awesome Epic Episode.
Oh, please don't.
It's the title.
The Japan trip was better. All right, guys. Well, we will come back next week with the mailbag stuff. We will hit on that next time. Don't forget to check out thefitcast.com. You can check us out on iTunes. Subscribe up in there. Again, we're going to hopefully be a little bit more regular now that my schedule and my travel is reduced a little bit. So, hopefully this provided some interesting discussion. And, you know, again, preface is that, you know, it should only be used as discussion, and make sure you're not doing anything you're not supposed to be doing with your athletes or clients and all that stuff. Did I cover the legal stuff?
Yeah. I think also, again, the general take home is not to say that you shouldn't be using the FMS. It's just that we don't know what you should be using it for. It's not a damning. Just because there's no evidence that it works, you know, per se, you know, based on the amount of evidence for, you know, there's not enough evidence yet that this works and is absolutely doing what it's supposed to, doesn't mean that it won't work.
Yeah, I still think it's beneficial to use this as a tool.
Yeah, no, I think so too. I especially agree with the whole idea of saying, like, you know, personal trainers and coaches, there's a lot to be asked for in the ways that they've been trained or not trained to evaluate. I think it's worthwhile. I really like it. I just not ready to use it yet. That's the only thing.
Cool. All right. Well, again, thanks everyone for listening. If you want to stick around, you can listen to the off-topic discussion where we talk about where I talk about my trip to Japan. John and Lee listen. And also we talk about Nintendo 3DS and Saints Row the Third, and also, you know, some pro tips on how to survive Walmart and get a $2 waffle iron on Black Friday. So
it's all about the pepper spray.
Dude, that bitch is nuts. We'll see you next week. We're here for the warm-up off-topic segment where we're going to talk about
the dynamic warm-up.
Mm. Yeah, it's the active warm-up that we do for the podcast.
Mm. Kind of is, isn't it? Because we always record this first, thinking that this will lighten our moods and make it for a good cast, and I don't think it's ever done that.
We go into the fun stuff cold. That doesn't seem right. Go into the boring stuff cold.
No, you start off with curls. You do the most important thing first.
Oh, that's true.
Start
buys before the tries.
Yeah, no, you do curls, and then you got to do equal amount of tricep exercises so you don't have any asymmetries, no imbalances. You don't want to have elbow pain, you know? That's actually a question from the CSCS test.
Look at you tying it in like that. Look at you.
Yeah. Well, in that
test, was that really a question in the CSCS?
Yeah, no, it's like when detecting elbow pain and you find that someone can do, like, you know, twice as much, they can curl twice as much weight as they can tricep press, what is the appropriate, like, prescription? And it was like, do more tricep presses. I'll find the question. I've sent it to Eric once. Eric used it in one of his presentations, but
top certain in the land, baby.
Yeah. Yeah, mine's supposed to be renewed next month. I don't know if I'm gonna do it or not.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know. I might just get the NASM CPT. I'm much happier with what NASM is doing these days than
Yeah, but dude, you already did it. Why would you let it go?
I don't know. I should probably just dig out some CUs, and then I gotta give them more money for more CUs.
You just do a bunch of them, you know, and just pay a bunch of this, you know, certifications, and just have tons of them, and just have more and more letters, just so many letters you can't even say it. That's what you need to do.
Yeah,
exactly.
To become John.
Yeah, well, exactly. What do you call it? You have in-service stuff at Boyle's. That counts.
No, I have plenty of CEUs from seminars, but you can only use like two CEUs from seminars or something like that.
No, well,
you have to do your, you have a certain amount of requirements that
you have.
And
you're going to pay them for a bunch of CEUs from their website education.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I did.
No.
Oh, really? Because I just recertified without a single thing from the NSCA.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that. Get me some CUs, dog.
I can get you hooked up.
We're supposed to be talking about something that's not about.
Okay. So how was Japan?
It was really good. It was great.
I want to hear all about it.
Yeah. So I just got back 3 days ago now. And so kind of adjusting to the time change. It took me about 4 days when I was out there to actually get on a proper sleeping pattern. Actually, maybe 5 days. I think the last two nights were the only nights that I actually like slept from 10 to, you know, 5:30 or something like that. But yeah, no, it was a crazy week where I pretty much did stuff every single day, and you definitely get there, and you know, I'll fully admit the first day I got there was complete culture shock. I was like, what? I don't even know what to do. Like, I was really overwhelmed with taking
all the Hello Kitty.
Yeah, well, it wasn't that. Like, the first, here's a quick story. The first night I was there, I stayed in Shinjuku. And that's a really nice, it's a pretty nice area. But it's right next to the red light district, which is Kabukicho. And the first night I'm walking around, like, everything is so compact. Everything looks very similar when you're there. So I thought I was pretty much staying in Shinjuku. And I knew the red light district was, like, right next to it. But I figured I would get some pretty clear signs of what was going on. But the first night I was there, I had been up for about 25 hours at that point. Couldn't really sleep on the plane just because the seats are so small. But I still, you know, I still was very excited to be there. So I got up and I took the shuttle from the hotel to Shinjuku Station, which is, as some may know, it's the busiest rail station in the world. And from there, I just started walking around, and, you know, I went up to a vending machine, got my favorite green tea, started walking around, was looking for something to eat because I hadn't eaten all day. And I couldn't really find anything that was in English or looked like food that I would want to eat. So instead I got something to eat at 7-Eleven. I went to 7-Eleven and got some like beef jerky or something like that. But anyways, you know, I'm walking around, I'm like, you know, kind of checking everything out. I'm literally, I think that first night I probably passed like hundreds of people. I was the only white person there. Which was, you know, again, it was one of those things, a culture shock where, you know, you're like, oh man, I feel like everyone's kind of looking at me because, you know, I'm like the 6'1" white guy with a shaved head. Which another thing I learned right before going is that, especially the older Japanese aren't too fond of the men with shaved heads because they tend to be, you know, military. They tend to be like the U.S. military that's stationed in Japan, so they're not huge fans of them. Anyways, you know, not that big. I really didn't get any hostility while I was there except for, you know, two or three occasions. But I'm walking around and, you know, I'm like, oh, it's pachinko parlors. I'm like, oh, yeah, no, I kind of expected that. But I kind of looked around because I felt like, oh, there might be like an arcade where I can just kind of sit down, you know, play some Street Fighter or something like that, like really jump right in and get into the culture and get my ass kicked. But then, you know, I started noticing a lot of Haitian guys standing out in the street, you know, kind of looking around. And so one of these Haitian guys comes up to me with, like, kind of, you know, decent English. He goes, oh, you want to have the greatest time of your life tonight? I said, oh, no. I kind of knew, I was expecting this. These guys that try to get you into the clubs and the strip clubs and like the hostess type bars. It's like these guys were being super persistent. Like this one guy followed me for like 100 yards. And I'm like, no, I'm just, you know, I'm going back to my hotel pretty soon. I'm really tired. He's like, no, don't pass this up. I'll get you 10% off. Like, no, I'm good. And he literally started grabbing, like putting his arm around me. And that was the point where I, like, you know, started kind of freaking out. I'm like, why are you putting, don't like touch me. I'm like, I'm just
walking around. That's what she
said. And, you know, there was two other guys. Like I kind of dodged the first guy. Then a second and a third guy did that to me. And, at that point I'm like, no, I'm pretty good. I jumped in a taxi because I at that point I was lost. I couldn't find my way back to the rail station. So at that point I knew I was in Kabukicho and I just kind of grabbed a taxi, went back to the hotel and then tried to go to sleep. So that was day one. And, and then I think that was the night, or maybe it was the second day that I talked to John on Skype, but I eventually, I think I was up at like 3:30 in the morning after going to bed at like 11 o'clock local time. And I was just wide awake at 3:30, 4 o'clock. So I went down to 7-Eleven, picked up some food there, picked up some green tea and coffee, and kind of chilled out in the hotel room, sat on the computer until it was let out. And I'm not going to go outside when it's 4 a.m. So people who tell me to walk the streets and don't understand the difference in time from place to place, that's what's up. So, the second day there, I went to Akihabara, and that's like the electric town. Bought some video games again, got lost a couple times, but eventually found my way back to the rail station. And, but the coolest, 2 days that I had there was with, Robert, who is a fan of the show, and Kono, who is his girlfriend, also joined us, and we kind of like walked around. And the first day, they took me. Where did we go the first day? I'm trying to remember. I literally can't remember what we did. I'm really tired right now. Sorry, I'm still kind of. I remember. So we went to Nakano, which is like their fashion district. We walked around there. Then we took a train to, we went to Harajuku first, which is the fashion district. Then we went to Nakano, and in Nakano, they have like a cool strip mall where he found a game store that he remembered. He and Kanoko were awesome. They were super nice, and they helped me quite a bit, and they really made that first major day there awesome, because they knew how to get around the rail station. They basically just let me follow them, and we got food, and we did so much stuff. It really was like a blur of a day because I was still really tired, and from like 10 a.m. till like 10 p.m. we were doing stuff, and we finished. We actually went back to Kabukicho for dinner. But they showed me all kinds of stuff. We got dumplings at this one place. What else did we do? We kind of just like walked around, and I just saw, kind of Tokyo in action. That's really kind of outside of Tokyo, but I won't get into it too much. Like, I could talk forever about it, but the second day that I hung out with them, they took me to all the shrines, which is like an hour and a half away from Shinjuku. So we took like an hour and a half train ride, and we got to see like Mount Fuji and stuff from the water. And I tried crab rice crackers. Or no, it was fish rice crackers, which were gross. I tried squid while I was there, and that was terrible. Anything was fish related was terrible there. At least for me, I don't like seafood, but at least I tried it. And I'm trying to think of the other major things. We took bike rides around all the shrines, and I tried all this random stuff, like random food. And I ate so much food while I was there; it was ridiculous. And I can't wait to go back. I miss like the people there. Like, you definitely, by the day seven, I was very comfortable, and the Japanese people overall were super nice, incredibly nice, very considerate when it came to language barriers and stuff like that. To be honest, it was a lot of it was coming from like shopkeepers that tend to be really nice. But every time you walk into a store, they always say, hello, thank you so much for coming in the store. And it's just nice to, come into a store and actually get greeted properly than just have someone like not pay attention to you or, not give you really good customer service. But the trip overall was, amazing. And it was, thanks to all the people that, I saw, and I also got to hang out with, Sam, who's a PT out there, and he showed me a couple of the Gold's gyms. in Harajuku, which again was really interesting. They pretty much only have like joggers and bodybuilders. Like that's everyone that exercises in Japan either just jogs all the time or wants to be a bodybuilder like Jay Cutler. They had Jay Cutler running 24/7 in the like a DVD loop of him lifting in the Gold's Gym on the TV, which was interesting. And yeah, I think that is about it. If you want to check out some pictures, I put a bunch of pictures of it on Facebook. So you can check those out. If you're my friend on Facebook, there's two albums, tons of pictures. The shrines, so like I said, were unbelievable.
What were they of? What shrines did you
see? I saw the Buddha. We went to Meiji Shrine the first day I was with Rob. There were so many shrines. One shrine, he's gonna send me some pictures, but there was one shrine where they like actually do like the green tea ceremony. Like if you ever seen Karate Kid 2,
yeah,
they actually do that you know the bowl turning ceremony that you can kind of sit in and you know have that done. And I actually got like real like mixed up green tea like how they used to do it hundreds of years ago, and drank some of that, which I thought was pretty good. They thought it was a little strong or bitter, but I'm kind of used to getting the real deal powder stuff. And
did you just say the real deal powder?
Yeah, it's like the real green tea that's not like, you know, flavored and stuff like that. It's just real, you know, somewhat bitter
green tea. Can powder be real deal?
Yeah, it's a real deal with Bill McNeil.
Mm.
It's a news radio reference, but yeah, like I said, unbelievable trip. I could have stayed there, you know, but it was definitely that first day. You are kind of overwhelmed with the difference, the language barrier, how most of the people won't be able to really speak anything other than no and thank you and bye-bye and hello. You know, that's what I got a lot of the times. And, you know, if they cross their arms, if I ask them a question, if they cross their arms, that meant no. And I did get called a gaijin three times. Once was in one of the game stores where I was wearing shorts when it was like pouring rain out. But I was wearing shorts because I didn't want my jeans, like the bottom of my jeans, to get soaked. Where most of the people in Japan, they actually roll up their jeans. And I don't think that looks particularly awesome. So when I was in one of the game stores, and I already had like a backpack full of stuff, so I was kind of like blocking the way. But all they had to do was say like "sumisen," which is just "excuse me," and I fully understand. Like I know almost a dozen words in Japanese that can get me, you know, out of situations. And I heard a couple words, and it was like two teenage kids that were out of school. Like it was right when school got out, and clearly they wanted to look in an area where I was looking, but I was in the way. But you know, I had like 80 pounds on each of them, so I could have kicked the shit out of them if I wanted to, but I didn't. It was a peaceful mission. It was a peaceful trip.
Oh my God.
But then I got to get called out like that. And then two businessmen who were like in their 60s while I was in the elevator coming down from my room were having a conversation. Like the one word I picked out was gaijin. And, that was awesome. So, yeah, like I said, overall, if you just want to go on my Facebook and you can check out all the pictures, I tried to take pictures of a lot of stuff, and it was, again, it was everything that I kind of hoped it would be. And, I fell in love with the place even more, with the culture, the people. It's a beautiful place, and considering how crowded it is, it's very clean. Everything's very efficient. And it's a trip that I think everyone should take. If you have any interest at all in going, I think you should really make that trip. And things are a little bit cheaper now because people are afraid of the earthquake and radiation and stuff, but it's really not that big of a deal.
Lee.
Yes.
Kevin just spent 17 minutes talking about Japan, possibly mm-hmm. without taking a breath. Mm. That is 16 minutes longer than he's ever let me speak in total of any of my trips.
You know, it's funny.
And that includes included detailed stories of beef jerky,
mm-hmm.
Jay Cutler's effing workout,
mm-hmm.
and him in his mind beating up some Japanese school kids.
Well, whose name's first on this list on the podcast?
Oh, he just took it to the real crucial spot. Who took it to the spot?
Who edits all the podcasts?
It's just funny because Katie was going over the outline with me because sometimes she reads it to me while I'm doing my training so I can figure out what's going to happen because I was training. And she was like, oh, Japan is in the outline. And I was like, yeah. And she was like, John's going to get pissed because she's getting to talk about his trip and John's not going to talk about his trip. And I was like, oh, that's really funny.
John goes on trips all the time. This is my one big trip of my life. This is the first time I've ever left the country. It was a big deal for me. John goes on trips every other day. He met, uh-huh. He's met, 2/3 of the Beatles. Get it? And, but that's the last thing I want to say. I got a Nintendo 3DS on Black Friday and, things dope. with Super Mario Land 3D. That game is worth buying that thing for.
I saw the preview where it looked fun.
No, that thing is, and John, you should really get one, especially with all that you travel.
I swear to God, I'm leaving a review on iTunes right now.
And Saints Row the Third, it's Grand Theft Auto, but tons of dick jokes and people get kicked in the balls. and also, like, you end up singing like Sublime songs in the car with the people that you're with. It's really funny. I highly recommend checking it out. It's actually kept my interest more than most things these days. But yeah, I ended up buying about 60 games while I was there. So,
so what was, if you had to sum up your trip, the most exciting thing that you experienced and what it really ultimately made you feel, what would you say? I mean,
I would probably have to say just that day trip that I took. To see all the shrines, it was like, I don't sightsee, and it was beautiful. Like, it was the most unbelievable thing that I've ever seen, and it was probably one of the top 3 days of my life.
Well, that's great. I'm so glad you had so much fun.
But traveling was terrible. Flying is terrible.
Not a fan, huh?
It literally took me 25 hours to leave once I left my hotel to get back to my house. So that was not so much fun. And, but yeah, no, it's a beautiful place and, it's got beautiful people and, the rail system is amazing. And like I said, I can't wait to go back. I'm getting ready. Hopefully Roger and I are going to go back very soon. So get him on that. But Lee or John, do you have anything to add to this? People wanted to hear about Japan, nothing. John.
I have nothing. Nothing to add. Did you see Godzilla? Did you have lunch with Mothra?
I saw Godzilla 2, the game. I'm trying to think what else. Like, I
God, would I say anything?
I ate with chopsticks a lot. I had seaweed and rice thing. People can see videos of that.
I heard about your seaweed and rice video and that went over very well.
Super bad. Don't ever eat it. And it's crazy. Like, you talk to the Japanese people out there and they love all that stuff. And it's so polar. It's such a polar opposite because I don't know. Like, Kano would like look at stuff that was like fish rice chips or fish rice things and think it was.
But did you try like other than like the seaweed and rice, did you try anything like really for you crazy? Did you like experiment with the eats or did you?
I definitely did. I didn't turn down trying anything. And
what was the best thing that you tried that you thought you weren't gonna like?
Okay, this is a weird thing. It was like okay, this is going to sound really bad, but it's not. It's like those McGriddles, how there's like syrup inside?
Yes.
It was kind of like set up like that, where it was like dough, but it had like a bean paste inside.
Hmm.
And the bean paste like that they use inside that is in like tons of stuff. Like like it was in these little green tea flavored, you know, bean things. Excuse me. And, I tried that and I thought it was pretty great. I had lots of crepes. Crepes are friggin' huge out there. There's a crepe stand every like 5 feet. Like they'll do crepes and they'll put like filling in it and then roll it up and like give it to you in a, like a cone. Crepes are huge. I had,
I've had crepes in Paris. Did you know that? Did you ever ask me about that?
Way better in Japan. Way better in Japan. Yeah. Also, green tea flavored ice cream, sweet potato flavored ice cream.
Was it good?
It was pretty good. Yeah. I had sesame seed flavored ice cream. What else did I have? I thought I had some other weird stuff. I probably did. I can't. Oh, like this bitter, like super salted, dried plums and stuff like that.
Did you have bird's nest soup? Because I had bird's nest soup with Prime Minister of Vietnam. Son of a bitch.
All right, well, I guess that's going to do it for the off topic. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Hope you enjoyed that. Again, hopefully you can find some great deals out there on this Black Friday. And if you're in Japan and listening, keep doing it, whatever that means.